Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and this is the final installment of Soundcheck's Writers Club. All week, we've been talking with best-selling authors about music. Yeah, we usually talk a little bit about books, too, but most of the time we talk about the music that our Writers Club authors grew up with, the songs that have wormed their way into their most recent books, or what they like to listen to while they're writing. Like Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Chabon. He only listens to instrumental music while he works, with one notable exception.
Weirdly, for some reason, I can listen to Yes. I can listen to, like, Tales from Topographic Oceans.
That is weird.
I know, or Relayer, maybe because the lyrics make no sense whatsoever.
We'll talk more with author Michael Chabon later in the show. But first, we hear from the R&B singer Betty LeVette. Her new memoir is called A Woman Like Me, a brutally honest take on her life, in music and outside, over the last 50 years. From her first single in 1962, to run-ins with pimps and producers, through a 20-year struggle to get her first album released. Betty LeVette, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, John. Thank you.
So this really is kind of par for the course for you. I mean, you've sung about your career and about, you know, people and the kind of the trials and tribulations that you've gone through. Mm-hmm. So was this, I mean, you know, you take a song like Before the Money Came, The Battle of Betty LeVette. Is this book kind of that story kind of writ large?
I think so. You have to realize, John, just before 8 or 9 years ago, these stories were all I had. All of my friends and neighbors had become stars and millionaires, and I would, just to make myself a part of what happened, I'd say, well, one time Martha Reeves and I did this, or one time this happened. So I only had these stories before now. And in doing the book with David Ritz, it was so funny because I've always kind of told the part of the story that would get your attention at dinner or wherever, and everybody would chuckle, and then that would be it. But in writing the book, which turned out to be less, more than conversational, mm-hmm. I would make a statement, and David Ritz would say, who? And I would say, who? And he'd say, and what were you doing when this happened? So I had to flesh the whole thing out a little more than I ever had before.
And those memories were still there?
Well, that was all I had to think about. Yeah. You know, I mean, a whole bunch of other things didn't happen to me, so I didn't have a whole bunch to dwell on.
We're speaking with Betty LeVette. Here is the song Before the Money Came, subtitled Battle of Betty LeVette. This is from the 2007 record Scene of the Crime.
All the money came. I was singing R&B back in 62 before you were born and your mama too. I knew David Ruff when he was over sleeping on my floor before we crossed over. All my friends on the Grammy shows. I was stuck in Detroit trying to open doors. Record deals kept falling apart.
Before the Money Came, subtitled The Battle of Betty LeVette. That's from Betty's 2007 album, Scene of the Crime, a song co-written with Patterson Hood from the Drive-By Truckers.
Yes.
So, I mean, without skipping over your whole life story and getting to the end of the book, I mean, eventually you find yourself working with lots of people that growing up, you know, was not necessarily your kind of genre, you know?
So there's the covers record of like British rock songs.
If you look at everything I've ever recorded, I've always done these kinds of tunes. I did What Condition My Condition Is In. I did on my live show, I was doing all the Beatles tunes. It's just that no one was willing to let me, very few people were willing to let me record this at length. Mm-hmm. You know, they would hear one that they liked, but nobody would ever let me do what I'm doing now.
And what you're doing now is not just a series of great records, but again, this biography that you've co-written with David Ritz called A Woman Like Me. And man, you know, there are biographies that have great opening lines. Keith Richards' life begins with a wonderful story. But nothing like this, where where we are not sure, Betty, if you are going to survive the first page of your own memoir.
My publicist said she was trying to read it in bed, and she was saying, Betty, no! And her husband said, you're going to have to go in the living room and read that.
So, line one, a vicious pimp was precariously holding on to my right foot as he dangled me from the top of a 20-story apartment building. You just jump right in.
Tell us what happened.
That vicious pimp is actually one of the few names in the book that you don't name. Mm-hmm. We just know him as Jay later on.
We figured if he still is alive, he'd definitely sue everyone I've ever met.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How did you get to that point? Because by this point, you had already had a hit single in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. How did you get to that point where you found your life being jeopardized by this guy from the streets
of
New York?
The career thing had really kind of fallen apart, or was slowly falling apart. And I think he probably knew that and saw that I would be helpless when it came apart, because it was all, when you're leaning on a record, which is what I tell young people now, you have to be able to lean on more than just the record. Even the record sells 20 million copies. At some point, it's going to stop selling. Mm-hmm. And when mine stopped selling, he was like there to help me up. And it was then when I lost my apartment, he was there to help me again. And then when I didn't get another gig, he was there to help me again. And, you know, after several months went by, he was like, well, now, how do you intend to pay all this money back? Hmm. And I was stunned, because I thought we were a couple, you know. And while, you know, he insisted that whatever money I made, I would give it to him, but it was more he was in charge of the money rather than give me your money. Mm-hmm. It was our money, and he was in charge of it. But then when I wasn't making any more, it was like, well, how do you intend to pay for all this rent and all this food you've had and clothes you've had to buy? And maybe I would need an outfit to go for a new record trial or audition or whatever. And so it kind of happened like that. It wasn't where he just cruised up and said, here, stop singing, you know, and come and be with me. It wasn't like that. It was almost like a blackmailish kind of thing,
right?
A vicious blackmail kind of thing.
Well, early on in the book, you know, when you talk about your early days in Detroit, it struck me that, you know, the thin line between pimps and producers, mm-hmm, in the Detroit music scene. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we sort of laugh and say, yeah, it was a man's world, but there's no laughing
matter.
It
really was really kind of popular at one point. The bigger pimps throughout the country had the bigger singers, and it wasn't looked upon as it's looked upon now. It was just as bad, but it just wasn't looked at as being as bad. And these people weren't trying to make us do anything other than sing. They just wanted the money when we sung, or mm-hmm, if we sung. And at one point in there, we're talking about Aretha Franklin, and it says that I had an affair with her husband. I don't know anything about him being her husband. I only know about him being a pimp, which everybody knew. I probably had to get more people to give me letters of verification on that than anything, because his life has certainly changed. And that certainly isn't what he is now, but that's what he was then. Mm. And everybody knew it. And he attested to it and said it out loud himself.
Now, this 1962, I mean, it seemed like you were on the road. You had this hit single, My Man, He's a Lovin' Man. How did that happen?
Well, in Detroit in 1962, it was no big deal to to record, just like my bad luck. It happens vicariously, and this did as well. It was no problem to record in Detroit, but to wind up on a label as big as Atlantic just happened because the person I recorded for happened to be with the Falcons, who had just said, "I found a love with Atlantic." So they already had a working relationship with Jerry Wexler and Ahmet Ertegun. So
the two heads of Atlantic mm-hmm. Records.
So here, let me let you hear this one by a young girl, Betty Levette. Would you listen to it? And they did, and Jerry Wexler liked it and bought it right on the spot. So while I recorded the song for a small label in Detroit, when it came out on the Atlantic record label, and people say, "Were you very upset about not being with Motown?" And I always say, no, Berry Gordy wanted to be with Atlantic in 1962. Mm-hmm. Maybe not in 1964, but in 1962 he did.
And you were, and this is what it sounded like. Betty Levette's 1962 single, "My Man, He's a Lovin' Man."
My man.
'62 single from Betty Levette, "My Man, He's a Lovin' Man." So you were already Betty Levette by then. You had taken the name.
No, I wasn't Betty Levette.
Okay,
yet.
So you were still.
When the record came out, all of 10 days, maybe 8 days. So in that week, I became Betty Levette. I became a recording artist, and I held a microphone for the very first time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I had not done any of this. All the only thing I had done before this was the work you're doing in ninth grade.
How old were you when that
song? I was 16 by the time it came out. I guess I had been out of school maybe 9 months. I had left at 15, but then came back and went back. And when the record came out, of course, this is who I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. No more school.
And the name Levette, you basically got it from another singer, right?
No, I got it from a groupie.
A groupie.
Who introduced me to everybody in Detroit. She knew all the pimps. She knew everyone with an Eldorado. All the pimps, all the singers. She knew their license plate numbers. I meant she knew every one of them, everybody black who had a record out. Mm-hmm. And she was introducing them to me and saying, "She can sing. You should hear her sing." And, you know, it was kind of like, you know, well, you know, I was with her, so. But then somebody, she said that too, said, "Well, let me hear her." And I sung a song and I said, "Yeah, you can sing."
And you liked the name Levette, and she said, "Take it."
Yeah, her name was Sherma Levette. Mm-hmm. Levette was her middle name.
We're speaking with Betty Levette. Her book is called A Woman Like Me. It's a biography, autobiography, co-written with David Ritz. And she's with us on Soundcheck today. Now, you mentioned the song came out on Atlantic. Jerry Wexler, Ahmet Ertegun. Ahmet seems to have, at least in early days, not have had a whole lot to say to you. But Jerry mm-hmm. Wexler, I mean, first of all, there's like a dizzying parade of men through this book. It was very hard to keep up, although certain names keep coming up who were obviously very important to you.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry Wexler, early on in your career, is trying to fix you up with a young songwriter named Burt Bacharach, and mm-hmm. you're not having any of it.
No, because, I mean, I know he had even Walk On By and Anyone Who Had a Heart. I think he had had maybe two things on Dion. But Lieber and Stoller had everything I had heard all of my life. They had recorded everybody I loved, everybody I admired, every song I knew. I got kicked out of school singing one of their songs in the talent show. So I loved them, but they had just left Atlantic at the very same time that I...
Right. But Jerry Wexler then says he's going to write you a $500 check because yeah. if you're leaving... He wants you to have something to
right.
kind of...
because it's apparent you're stupid, so...
Well, now, you refer to buzzard luck several times during the course of the book. And, you know, a lot of people have heard these stories of, you know, an album gets recorded and then the producer is fired or the label goes under. So, but at some point, do you think of, for example, the Jerry Wexler, Burt Bacharach conversation and say to yourself, you know, gosh, I wish I had actually done that one?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. That was my first business decision made alone, and the worst business decision I ever made in my life. Even just sitting there, Jerry probably would not have let me starve. He probably would have written me another $500 check, you know, just as he later did for my producer, Ollie McLaughlin. Every time he got broke, he wrote him a check. But, and I'm sure that they would have been willing to do that, and I would only, when I, even after that, after I left Atlantic, I would call him and say, would you send me $50 or just send me $75 or whatever, and he would.
Now, how old were you when you made that decision? And why were you making the decision without, like, an agent or a lawyer or a manager?
Well, my manager had been shot, which is why I was in New York. And I figured while I was there, I would go and handle this business. Mm. And my manager had been shot by Mary Wells' husband, Mary Wells, who was the biggest black rhythm and blues singer of the day. You know, so when you say buzzard luck, the things that have happened to me have been just so different than any of the bad things that have happened to anyone else, you know.
Yeah, and it's been one thing after another. And then comes the British invasion in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of American ears are suddenly, you know, facing the other side of the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. And that, what did that do to, you know, to your career, to your ability to make a career in the 70s?
Well, it probably hindered it because I was far down on the recording chain, but impaired the other artist who was still living in Detroit, who was still my friends, who were doing well, who gave me money and drugs and whatever else. It impaired their careers, which was a definite infringement on my livelihood.
Right. So that pipeline was beginning to dry up a
absolutely,
little.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So this makes the irony even more delicious, that the song that brings you to the Kennedy Center Honors and puts you on national TV and puts you in front of the glitterati of American society is a song from The Who.
It's a pretty song. I love it. And, you know, my husband was one of those young white kids in the 60s and 70s who worshiped these people and still does. And so that moment, that Sunday morning, to be looking up at Pete Townsend, who was sitting right next to Barbara Streisand, whose success happened at the same time mine did, except that hers went on, mine didn't. And then Aretha was sitting on the lower floor right directly in front of me. And then across from her was sitting Beyonce. I call it my Three Stooges slap.
It apparently brought the house down. You're right, Pete Townsend was visibly crying while you sang his song.
So that was good for my husband to see.
And how did that feel?
I'm telling you, that was good for my... It was good seeing my husband see that.
Mm.
You know, it's like there's nothing. I will never be able to sell as many records as these people have. I would never be able to have as many people in my audience. I just don't even have that kind of time. If everything went right from now on, I just don't have that kind of time. But I did have that moment.
That moment, the Kennedy Center Honors in Washington, D.C., 2008, when my guest Betty Levette sang The Who's Love, Rain or Me, later included on the 2010 collection Interpretations, the British Rock Songbook.
Love, love.
recorded live at the Kennedy Center Honors in 2008 and then included 2 years later on her record Interpretations. That is Betty Levette, my guest on Soundcheck today, with her version of The Who's Love, Rain, or Me. And her book is called Betty Levette, A Woman Like Me. That is one hell of a lived-in voice. I mean, and you can take that however you want, but what
No, no, I take it as a compliment. Yeah. I really do.
So how, I mean, through a life and a career that has been turbulent, that has seen its share of drugs and alcohol and abuse and stuff, how have you kept that instrument? You know, how have you taken care of that instrument?
People assume that because I took some drugs, I abused them. I never had enough money to abuse drugs. And I have always liked singing better than I do anything. I can only be so drunk, which is about the only thing that I do now, to stand up on 6-inch heels or 5-inch heels and dance back and forth across the stage. I can only smoke so much marijuana, or none at all, when I'm performing because it dries your throat up. Mm-hmm. And I sing too hard, so I just wouldn't be able to do it. And the other stuff, one of the first things I was taught by all of these pimps and drug dealers was the difference between cocaine and heroin. And I learned never to touch the heroin. And the cocaine just really, I never found it that fascinating. It was just so popular at one point. Everywhere I went, it was there. I blew it, but never bought any, never had any. Hmm. But if it was there, I have sat and blown it for 2 or 3 days. But when I went home, it was over.
And, you know, would you have periods where, you know, you would really start worrying about what am I doing to, you know, to my voice?
No, because I didn't have any job and I didn't have any cocaine. So there was nothing to worry about.
The story is such a roller coaster because every time it seems like you've hit a wall, hit a dead end, there would come this opportunity. And you know, the 20-year wait to do your first record. And when the record comes out, it's a different woman's picture on the cover.
Can you stand that?
I still don't quite understand. I know you try and you make an attempt to recount the record company's explanation
that
for how this happened.
That is what they told me, which is the most ridiculous answer I've ever heard in my life, considering.
But, you know, with all of the stuff that you write in the book, perhaps the most provocative thing that you say is about how men have traditionally treated women. You know, you talk about Aretha getting slapped around by her husband, you getting beaten up by some of your boyfriends. Ike and Tina, you know, the fact that Tina Turner wouldn't have been Tina Turner, wouldn't have been rich if it wasn't for Ike, and that, you know, the way Hollywood portrayed Ike Turner was sort of unfair and stuff. Have you gotten a lot of pushback from that?
No, I think that I get more because Tina and Diana so greatly love and so deservedly so, and I understand why they are. But the only thing that I really was saying in terms of Tina, I didn't think that any of the people were right for hitting any of us. But Tina, the only thing I said about Tina was that she could have left at any time she wanted because she was so loved and so desired by so many men of all ilk and run of life. So that could have been done. But in terms of her, I felt, and most musicians feel, that Ike was much more talented than she, and because he was, just as Jim was much more talented than me, and that was why he was able to, he wasn't as cute and didn't look the same way on stage, so he was able to give me everything that he knew. And that was just what Ike did, although I'm sure that Ike had such an attitude, he probably felt he was as cute as Tina. Mm-hmm. But he taught her everything that he knew. And she's very soft-spoken, very bashful. I don't think she would have left home, pulled her dress over her head, and screamed and hollered like that with no provoking whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. When you mentioned Jim, by the way, I alluded before to
Jim Lewis.
Right, to several of the men who actually came into your life and stayed, and Jim Lewis was sort of your mentor, sort of played lots of different types of music
for
you, telling you if you could sing jazz, you could sing anything.
Yes,
which turned out to stand you in very good stead.
Yes. He told me you may never be a star, but if you will learn a lot of songs, learn how to sing them, you can sing the rest of your life. As long as you can sing, you can sing.
Now, and then at another point, much later in the book,
Someone, and I forget who it is, asks you if you're going to write a song, you know, for one of your more recent albums, and you say, I don't write songs, I interpret them.
Mm-hmm.
Have you never wanted to write your
yes,
own songs?
Yes, I want to write. I want to play piano too, but I don't know how to do either one. You know, when I think of something to write, I write it,
mm-hmm.
you know, but I just know that another song should have come to my head since before the money came, if I were a real writer, you know, and then just to force it because I can make some songs rhyme. I don't even want to become famous for writing shoddy little songs that just sell in a weak market like we have right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, your most recent record is called Thankful and Thoughtful. Now, you were saying before, and you're writing about all these people in the past, Diana Ross, Aretha, whoever, that they're not the same people now. You're a different person now from
absolutely.
The 16-year-old, the 19-year-old who made that fateful decision.
I'm James and Marissa's grandmother now and Kevin's wife. And the oldster who's bringing up the rear, you know. So I don't even have the energy to be who I used to be.
Mm. So is Thankful and Thoughtful more than just a title for you?
Oh, I'm Thankful, Thoughtful, and Stunned should have been it. You couldn't have told me I was ever going to have another record contract at 55 years old for a guy who's the same age as my daughter to say, we'd like to do a record on you. I'm stunned.
Mm-hmm.
And the book is just overwhelming. This is just almost unreal.
And you open that book up, and there among the pictures, you and Barack Obama, a grinning Barack
Isn't
Obama,
incredible?
Who is clearly, you know, completely thrilled to be
Isn't
standing
that
next
incredible?
To you. Yeah, it is.
I am the people, especially like Mother Ernesta, whomever said she's never going to be anything. I am just as stunned as they are.
Betty Levette, the book is called A Woman Like Me. It is, you can't take your eyes off the page. I mean, you never know what's going to come up next. Betty, it's been a real pleasure having you with us on Soundcheck
John, thanks
today.
So much for talking with me.
Here is a little bit from that album, the new album called Thankful and Thoughtful.
Should have been happy, Lord, not still be there. Some could have come along and taken me away, but the powers that be said I should have another day, and that's why I'm so thankful.
Up next, we talk with author Michael Chabon about his latest book, Telegraph Avenue, a modern tale about the old-fashioned record store. This is Soundcheck. Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Michael Chabon has a knack for telling big, sometimes heartbreaking, often impactful stories through pop culture. The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay used the history and tropes of comics. The Final Solution wrapped a tale around the mysteries of Sherlock Holmes. Now he goes inside the world of the record store with his latest called Telegraph Avenue. The book is full of music, so much music that the e-book even comes with a playlist that includes this track. Michael Chabon, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
So what are we listening? Who is Deodato?
Deodato is a Brazilian composer, keyboard player, arranger. He had his heyday in the early to mid-1970s. He's probably best known. That track is called Superstrut.
Right.
It's a great track, and amazing guitar work by John Tropea on that track on lead guitar. But Deodato was probably best remembered for his very jazzy, funky cover of the theme from 2001 that also sprach Zarathustra.
The 2001 Space Odyssey.
Right, and
theme.
If you've seen the movie Being There, it's used to incredibly great effect in that film when Chauncey Gardner first walks out into the world. That's what's playing. And
can I tell you, as a little kid, I accidentally discovered David Bowie because I bought Space Oddity thinking I was buying Deodato's.
That's hilarious.
2001 Space
I wonder
Odyssey.
How many sales that accounted for of Major Tom.
One. One.
It's an easily made mistake.
So, but this is, I mean, this is part of the kind of soundtrack of this epic story that is a very intimate epic. I mean, it's centered around Brokeland Records on Telegraph Avenue in the East Bay,
right,
in Northern California. How much of a real place is this based on?
Well, in a way, it's a very idealized sort of amalgam of a number of different establishments that have come and gone over the years since I first moved to Berkeley in 1997. The direct initial inspiration came one day about 1999 or so when I walked into a record store I hadn't been in before called Berrigan's that was on Claremont Avenue. It was a small store, not as spacious and as quite a great of a hangout as the record store in my book. It was smaller, but the day that I walked in there, there were two guys working there, and one was white and one was black, and there were a bunch of guys hanging out, talking, or came in and went, and they had little conversations, and there was a vibe of conversation going in that store, and the people were themselves, the customers were black and white, and nobody was really buying too many records. They seemed to be mostly hanging out and talking and just shooting the breeze and gossiping, and you know, I was just really struck by the way in this very tiny little microcosm, some black people and some white people seem to have figured out a way to just hang out together and talk about the things that they care about. And that triggered a powerful response in me, I think, principally because I grew up in a town called Columbia, Maryland. That was a planned community that was built between Baltimore and Washington in the 1960s. And it was planned, it was designed and constructed around very, you know, 1960s enlightened great society kind of principles. It was intended to be racially integrated. I grew up thinking the world was like that. You know, when I left Columbia, I rapidly, very rapidly discovered the world is not like that.
Yeah.
And it never was like that again until the day I walked into that record store. And even though that was just a store and not a city, it still chimed for me. It made me remember Columbia, and it made me see how far I had gone afield from the kid I was at age 8. I had lost, black people had once been very visible in my life, and they had become invisible, and I was looking for a way to try to make them visible again.
Now, you remember back in the 70s, that was sort of the end of when radio would play black and white artists.
Yes.
You would hear Stevie Wonder followed by the Rolling Stones, followed by whatever.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, that's part of why the 70s are very much the touchstone decade for this book, for the people in this book.
I just want to say it's not set in the
70s. No, it's set in 2004. Mm-hmm. But the guys who work in this record store specialize in this, the music like we were just listening to, the Deodato, the stuff that was on CTI Records and Blue Note in the 70s, and which in itself was a very much the product of the interaction between black artists, white composers and black composers and arrangers and engineers. And part of what still continues to appeal to me about the music of that period is the way in which it seemed to not just cross over boundaries, but to completely ignore them.
Well, it's not just that the music in the novel, and again, the book is called Telegraph Avenue by my guest Michael Chabon. It's not just that the music is the pop figures that you're referencing. I mean, yes, Stevie Wonder and some of the prog rock of the 70s,
right,
get shout outs.
Mm-hmm.
But the heart and soul of the lives of these people is this kind of soul jazz,
right,
of the early 70s. Now, did you grow up with that, or did you have to research
No,
this?
I mean, well, it turned out I did grow up with it, but I just didn't know it. It was almost like that character in Molière who has been speaking prose his whole life and didn't know it. You know, I didn't know there was a name for this music like that Deodato. You know, it formed part of a continuum of music that started out being called hard bop in the 50s, came to be known as soul jazz. The music transformed over those years and then ultimately kind of ended its greatest incarnation as jazz funk. And what it all really means is music played by jazz musicians, but with the backbeat pushed really centrally into a position of prominence in the music. There was this movement that arose in the 50s among black musicians to restore the gospel roots, the blues roots to the music, and hard bop. The first hard bop album is usually viewed as having been Horace Silver and the Jazz Messengers' mm-hmm. first album. From that period, what you can see that I think makes the music really fun, especially the music from the late 60s and early 70s, is that this was music performed by musicians aware of what was going on in popular music around them, and especially black popular music.
And sometimes, as with Mongo Santa Maria or Herbie Hancock, they would actually cross over and become popular.
Right.
But more often, they sort of fell into this deep well of obscurity from which occasionally they're rescued by crate divers and people like you, Michael.
Right.
So
hip-hop has been very instrumental in
exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these completely obscure records, we hear their breaks, those
exactly.
drum breaks.
And that was the other thing, the reason I discovered I did know it. I had grown up with it. And, you know, especially the big period for hip-hop for me was like from the late 80s through the mid-90s, just before the Wu-Tang Clan era, the Biggie and Tupac era. I sort of lost touch with hip-hop around then. But that intermediate era is when people like, you know, Q-Tip from A Tribe Called Quest and the guys in De La Soul, and they were really digging deep into a lot of this material. But I just didn't know that. When I heard these things, I thought, oh, I recognize that. That was in a Tribe Called Quest song, or that was in a Organized Confusion song. It turned out I knew more about it than I thought I did.
So one of the pieces on the playlist that comes with the ebook version of Telegraph Avenue is Manziel and the Midnight Theme.
Yeah.
I have never heard of Manziel, but
do you recognize it?
I sure do. I mean,
especially that initial break, right? That's like
from 3 Feet High and Rising,
right.
That classic record from De La Soul. You might recognize it as well, but this is the original from the band Manziel. Midnight Theme by Manziel, a tune that was later sampled by De La Soul on their 1989 album 3 Feet High and Rising, but this original appears on the playlist that accompanies the ebook version of Michael Chabon's new novel Telegraph Avenue. The book is centered around a used record store that specializes, Michael, not just in vinyl, but in this kind of vinyl.
Right.
It's a little, I mean, people will who haven't read the book will think, well, Nick Hornby, you know, High mm-hmm. Fidelity, mm-hmm. the 1995 book.
Great book.
And
great
effectively
movie too.
Turned into
yes.
a movie mm-hmm. as well. But was there any inspiration there or?
I read the book right when it came out and I really loved it. And same goes for the movie. And I still think that's one of Jack Black's best performances ever.
Mm-hmm.
But the situation of the guys who work in the store in my book is, and the reasons that they work in a record store, they do overlap to a certain degree. I mean, they overlap to the degree that they are like the characters in Nick Hornby's book. They love the music.
Right.
And it's the thing they love most in the world. But other than that, I mean, they're older. In the case of Nat Jaffe, he's married. He has a kid. They're in a different position in life. They're actually in more of a position where maybe it's time for them to start making some more serious choices.
Yeah.
It's not just about which girl is the girl for me anymore, for these guys. It's more like, are you really going to keep doing this for the rest of your life, or is it time to get serious?
Especially with the encroachment of a huge record chain, which is moving in down the block and,
right.
you know, has a lot of money and a very famous ex-NFL player behind it. So
and a progressive social agenda, too.
Right.
They're trying to, like, improve this down-at-heel neighborhood and bring some needed community pride because it's a black-owned chain, mm-hmm. and they're going to be employing a lot of local people. It's this horrible thing that's happening to Nat and Archie in their store, but for everybody else, it looks like a great blessing. So it really puts them on the wrong foot.
We're speaking with the author Michael Chabon, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and novelist. His new book is called Telegraph Avenue. He's with us in the Soundcheck studio. When you're writing, generally, do you listen to music?
Always.
And what kind of, I mean, what we've been listening to so far has been instrumental.
Yeah, and pretty much has to be instrumental. I can listen to vocal music if the lyrics are in a foreign language that uh-huh. I don't know at all. sometimes, but even that can get a little intrusive. It's much better if it's instrumental. And then weirdly, for some reason, I can listen to Yes. I can listen to like Tales from Topographic Oceans.
That is weird.
I know. Or Relay, or maybe because the lyrics make no sense whatsoever. And it just, or I know it so well, I don't really hear the lyrics anymore. Mm-hmm. And there's a few other bits like that where it's vocal. But it does, the ideal piece of music for writing for me is Steve Reich's Music for 18 Musicians, which has everything that music ideally would have to be good writing music for me. It's propulsive. It's instrumental. I mean, there are vocals, but they just are sounds. They sound like instruments. It is dynamically stable, and that's kind of the most important thing, because I can't work when the music's constantly getting quieter and louder, quieter, louder. That I find that very distracting, and Music for 18 Musicians is very steady in that way. It fades perfectly into the background, but not all the way into the background, and it stays at just enough level of consciousness that it helps me to sort of shut out my environment and focus on the work at hand without intruding. Over time, I've learned to work to all kinds of other music. Mm-hmm. When I was writing The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, I worked to big band swing and Benny Goodman quartets and stuff like that. I do program the music to suit the project if I can. Sometimes it's weird things that work well don't actually bear any obvious relation to the material that I'm working on, and yet somehow or other it's the right thing.
Well, I mean, you know, Juno Diaz was on the show not too long ago.
He's
and basically
great.
Saying the same thing. You know, he can work to instrumental music, but he can only work to vocal music if he's already got the idea and he's now just working the stuff out.
You're not listening anymore, yeah.
So, for example, Amanda Palmer.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't write listening
that would
to
just,
her.
I don't think that could work. No, that would be too, I would be too busy paying
attention.
Okay
for her to get married to Neil Gaiman in your house, but not okay to be on the stereo. That,
those were the
writing.
Terms of the agreement.
Yeah, okay.
Definitely.
The idea of vocal music, instrumental music, it sort of goes to a big difference between Nat and Archie, the two guys who run the record store, and their sons. There's little spoiler happening there.
Teenage boys. Yeah. Yes, Titus and Julie.
Julie listens to not just vocal music, but the kind of vocal music that you have already referenced. Yes,
uh-huh.
Prog rock.
Right.
Kansas, much to his dad's chagrin.
Yeah, Jethro Tull, but like weird late Jethro Tull, like Bungle in the Jungle. You know, I mean, for Julie, he has inherited his father's and Archie is a kind of uncle figure for Julie, someone he's known all his life. He has both inherited their tendency to valorize the art of the 1970s, like he's into blaxploitation movies and Kubrick films and you know he recognizes the value in the stuff that his father and his friend Archie love, but he still has to find a way to rebel and annoy and irritate his father. And so he very cleverly sort of seizes on this one sort of genre of music that drives his father insane and yet is somehow also impeccably credentialed from the point of view of being from the proper decade.
But Kansas, yes, were these your bands as a kid?
Well, I still love prog to this day and unapologetically so. I mean, Kansas... right. I mean, I got to admit, I have a little bit of a soft spot. And when Carry On My Wayward Son comes on the radio or Point of No Return, it does stir some deep memories of going around the roller rink, you know, when I was 15 years old, trying to follow some girl. But a lot of the great prog from that period, King Crimson, the early Yes stuff, the early Genesis. Some of the little more out there bands like Gentle Giant or Stackridge or Hatfield in the North and Soft Machine. I mean, that stuff, I still listen to it all the time. I didn't, when I was a kid, I didn't like the more outre stuff that much. But, you know, it was much more about Yes and Genesis. But, and that stuff, I still like those early Yes albums, Fragile, Relayer, Close to the Edge. Close to the Edge, maybe above all, is just impeccably great music.
Now, Close to the Edge is referenced in passing,
yes,
in the book, but the song that you actually quote lyrics from is the song Portrait He Knew from the band Kansas. Portrait He Knew by the band Kansas from their 1977 album Point of No Return. That song is actually quoted, the lyrics, in Michael Chabon's new novel Telegraph Avenue, a book that is full of music, not necessarily this kind of music in terms of the two main protagonists,
right,
who like more of the soul jazz stuff, Michael, that we were talking about. I like that every time you mention a record, even when it is Point of No Return, in parentheses is the date and the record label. Even if you don't tell us who the artist was,
Point
of No Return appears, and it's like, I know that name. And like a few paragraphs later, it's like, this is Kansas he's talking about. It isn't until the next page that you actually identify the band.
When the father, in horror, says, you're not listening to Kansas, are you?
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I have to say, first of all, that sounded pretty good to me.
Yep.
Those guys could play their instruments, and, you know, electric violin and tricky time signatures can warm the heart of an old prog head.
So, you know, this the story of Telegraph Avenue is taking place. It's 2004.
Correct.
There are still record stores, you
right.
know.
Well, that was the thing.
The internet is coming.
Right.
It's looming.
Right.
Is owning a record store now an act of nostalgia, of like almost willful nostalgia?
I don't think it's nostalgia. I don't think it's an act of nostalgia. I think nostalgia is one of the impetuses for doing it. It's about love. It's an act of love. You have to love what you do. And, you know, if you love records, and there's ample reason to love records because they're great and they sound fantastic and they look good and they provide a multi-sensory experience that digital music's just never going to give you, even if it sounds wonderful. And of course, the best digital music, highest resolution, sounds very good indeed. But the combination of the full package with the photography, the typography, the liner notes, you know, the smell coming off the old cardboard, and then, you know, the music itself that sounds so wonderful on vinyl if you have an adequate system for playing it. It's you know, you are passionate about it and you want other people to help share that passion and maybe make a little money off it. You're never going to be looking to make a killing. You know, records aren't going, knock on wood, they're not going away. There's, you know, I think I read that more vinyl records were sold last year, new ones,
yeah,
than in any year since the CD first emerged or something.
It certainly has made a big comeback.
Yeah, so, and our new store is opening as we speak on Telegraph Avenue in Oakland. A record store called Stranded Records is opening up now. I just accidentally stumbled on it before they opened, and you know, is it a quixotic thing to be doing? Possibly, but they must think they're going to be able to make a go of it.
We've been speaking with Michael Chabon. Telegraph Avenue is the name of his new novel, which is a sort of multi-sensory experience with the book cover that looks like a record and,
right,
of course, the ebook with the accompanying playlist, which includes Johnny Hammond Smith and It's Too Late. This is another example of that kind of early 70s soul jazz,
right,
that, Michael, you clearly feel passionate about, as you clearly do about lots of different forms of music. Thank you so much for sharing some of that with us
on Soundcheck
today.
Oh, it's been really fun for me, too. Thank you.
This is Soundcheck. Up next, we wrap up Soundcheck's Writers Club with a look at how a few musicians have paid tribute to their favorite authors and novels in song. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We're wrapping up our Soundcheck Writers Club series with a look at how some famous novels have jumped off the page and onto records. David Bowie's 1984, Iron Maiden's Brave New World, Kate Bush's Wuthering Heights. You get the picture. Writer Michael Azarad is here with me in the studio, and Michael, I want to ask you why you think so many books end up being the basis for songs.
Often, you know, songwriters are just, you know, looking for material, and if they happen to be reading a book and they want to, you know, write about what they know, basically, which is something that's on their mind, which is the book they're reading, you know, that's a great source of inspiration. For instance, David Byrne had that song called The Book I Read. And the opening lines are, I'm writing about the book I read. I have to sing about the book I read.
Right.
That kind of says it all. You know, it's songwriters will write about something that's on their mind. So there it is.
Well, and in the case of some artists, they write about the books that they've been reading, and perhaps they don't always tell you what the book is, but you know, they kind of leave it to you to figure out. For example, Bruce Springsteen with The Ghost of Tom Joad, you know, I don't think he ever sings the word grapes or wrath anywhere on this album, but it's pretty clear that the Steinbeck book is behind the inspiration behind this.
And I think that's a really, really great thing. I mean, a lot of kids grow up, you know, reading Steinbeck in high school or something like that, so a lot of people would kind of get the reference anyway. But if you're a Springsteen fan and you don't get the reference, maybe you go to, you know, Google or Wikipedia or something and look it up, and then, boom, maybe Bruce Springsteen just turned you on to John Steinbeck, which I think would please Springsteen quite a lot.
This is from The Ghost of Tom Joad by Bruce Springsteen.
Tom said, Mom, wherever there's a cop beating a gun, wherever a hungry bone baby cries, there's a fight against the blood and hatred in the air. Look for me, Mom, I'll be there. Well, there's somebody fighting for a place to stay. A decent job or a helping hand. Maybe somebody struggling to be free. Look in the eyes, Mom, you'll see me.
Well, Bruce Springsteen all but setting John Steinbeck to music in The Ghost of Tom Joad. Go back even further to 1967 and the Jefferson Airplane with White Rabbit drawn from the pages of Lewis Carroll.
And if you go chasing rabbits and you know you're going to fall, tell them a hookah smoking caterpillar has given you.
With inspiration from the book that we commonly and incorrectly call Alice in Wonderland, that is Jefferson Airplane and White Rabbit. And from just around the same time, just a couple of years later, we could actually do a whole segment just on how Tolkien has influenced Led Zeppelin.
Just in the darkest depths of Mordor, I met a girl so fair. But Gollum, the evil one, crept up and slipped away with her.
Ramble on, early Led Zeppelin, and we're talking with Michael Azarad about when musicians look for their inspiration to the world of literature, and whether it's Tolkien or Steinbeck or anybody in between. Michael, it seems to be... it's not just instrumental. I mean, in fact, it's almost never instrumental music. I shouldn't say that. But, you know, especially in the rock world, we're talking about people who are taking names, they're taking lines of text and kind of incorporating that into the songwriting process. Mm. So is it one of those things it kind of fires the inspiration? Is that what songwriters are looking for?
I mean, I think songwriters are inspired by just about anything they come across. Maybe they see a piece of chewing gum in the street and it might, you know, kick off some sort of association that they might run home and write something down. And something like a book is just, you know, loaded with ideas and inspirations and thoughts and new ways of thinking.
Right.
It's just something, it's fodder, you know, and it's something that kicks off other ideas.
And if you're really enthusiastic about a book, the first thing you want to do is tell all your friends about it, usually. And
right.
if you're a songwriter, here's a chance to tell thousands of your best friends about a book that you read, to go back to the David Byrne analogy that you made before.
Sure. Songwriters, you know, they put what's on their mind in their songs.
Right.
And if they happen to be reading a book, that's it might wind up in a song.
There are a number of comments coming in on the website. Steve Almas, musician himself. The lyrics to Sympathy for the Devil were inspired by the novel The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov. Marianne Faithfull gave Mick Jagger the book.
Yeah, and, you know, therein lies a tale, the romance of Marianne Faithfull and Mick Jagger, for one thing. But, yeah, the opening lines of that song, let me please introduce myself, I'm a man of wealth and taste, that, you know, that harks back to The Master and Margarita, where the devil is a sophisticated gentleman. And I'm sure there are a couple of more references to the book, you know, enclosed in that song.
Please allow me to introduce myself, I'm a man of wealth and taste. I've been around for a long, long year, stole many a man's soul and faith.
Thanks to author Michael Azarad for helping us wrap up the week-long Writers Club on Soundcheck. You can hear the whole week's worth of conversations with authors and musicians about music and books at soundcheck.org. And while you're there, check out the summer reading recommendations from our friends over at the New York Public Library and some picks from our very own Soundcheck staff. On Monday's show, the 70s rock band Big Star is at the center of a new documentary called Big Star, Nothing Can Hurt Me. We'll talk with co-director Drew DiNicola and Big Star drummer Jody Stevens. Plus, we'll talk with 30 Rock and SNL composer Jeff Richmond about adapting his wife Tina Fey's film Mean Girls for the stage. And we'll hear a live performance in the green space from slide guitarist Robert Randolph and his family band. That's going to do it for Soundcheck today. See you next time. I'm John Schaefer.